Accession number 27185, reel 38.
Major Barras, reel 38. Do you know if the British authorities were actually in contact with Aung San at that time? Were there negotiations going on?
Oh, I think definitely, yes. Because, as I say, Aung San was calling strikes, which people were coming out. I think they had to negotiate with him, yes, to get the strikes called off. And I think, as I mentioned before, he was rather keen that his ragbag army should form the basis of the Burma army, which, naturally enough, was also refused. But at the end of the day, of course, he took power when independence eventually came in 1948. But we're back, I think we're in 1946 now, aren't we?
Yes.
I was just thinking, going through the sort of year, I think we're just getting to the end of the monsoon period, and entering into the dry season, where the climate was much improved and it was dry, and that's when most of the activities took place, because it was easier to get around and get out and organise. at this time, there were families coming out, but there were very few of them. They were families of regular officers and WOs and so forth, who were going to be expected to be posted there for a period to make it worthwhile. And I remember rations, of course, were very short, so families were living off compo rations as well. So there weren't enough. I remember on one occasion at a meeting, I heard that the quartermaster, the camp commandant, who was in charge of sort of distribution of rations, had organized somebody to go around with tins of apricots. And they bang on the door, and Mem Sahib came to the door with a fork and a plate and was proffered a tin of apricots opened, and said she could take two out, which she would do with her fork, and then they moved on to the next house. And so it was until food got better. But I think, as I mentioned before, we used to have weevils in the bread. I don't know whether I mentioned this, but we used to have to pick the weevils out of the bread, which had got in the flour, and there was no way around it at that stage, because we just didn't have the facilities for proper storage. I did do a number of visits during this period out of Rangoon with the General Briggs. I remember one which we did by car. He had a black Rolls Royce, which he used to drive out in. And the form was that two jeep loads of CMPs would go in front. And on the front of the first jeep was a great big board made out like a checkerboard, like you play chess on, with the words "Army Commander Following" in about three languages. And then, having done that, the idea was to tear down the road as fast as you could, because everybody had to get out of the way. We used to tear down the road, going up to, say, Make Tiller or something like that. It was a straight, dusty road. And we used to roar down there, and Briggs would sit at the back puffing his pipe, completely unaware of the chaos that was being caused down the road. But most people got the warning in time, because there were outriders on motorcycles as well, to stand off the road. But now and again there was a bullet cart that didn't get out of the way sometimes, or had to push off suddenly and find itself in the ditch. But on a couple of other occasions I went with him on trips right out to make first one to Lashio, and another one to Michinawa, right up on the China border. And we went by his plane, of course, with one or two others. And in these places, he would inspect the local forces, Chins particularly, I remember, at Michinawa. They weren't fully trained, and he did a march past, and I stood on the platform with him, whilst he took the salute, just standing behind him. I'd never been on a platform before, looking at the parade from this angle. But there were masses of them. There must have been two or three battalions marching past. They didn't have a band, so they had a bass drum which beat all the time as they went past to keep the step. I think he really went up there to see how they were getting on and to encourage them. But they went on and on and on, and it became like a nightmare because they were all facing you. They all looked very much the same. And it went on for a long time. I can still see them now if I close my eyes.
What sort of weapons did they have?
I don't think they had weapons at that stage. I can't remember.
Were they in uniform?
Yes, they were in uniform, yeah. Jungle green with those awful jungle green hats. But because the Burma army wasn't just the Burma rifles, there were the Karens as well, or Karen rifles. They had their own regiment, as well as the Chins, Anka Chins. So it was a mixture. But I don't know, as you know, I mean, after we left and the dictatorship took over, the Karens and everybody else had a rough time. I don't think part of the army exists anymore. It's very sad, actually, because I think that Burmese people were lovely people. They were helpful, smiling, happy-go-lucky people, and they certainly don't deserve what they're getting now. It's terrible. But I was amazed to find when we got to Michinar that there was a railway station there. And I looked on the map and I found that the railway runs all the way from Moulmein down in the south, right through Rangoon, up there, well over 1,000 miles, which was built during the time. So the empire did have leave some benefits behind.
What was General Briggs like? Did you get a chance to get an idea?
He was a very large chap. He was very amenable, actually, amicable chap. He didn't speak an awful lot. I think he must have been fairly competent, general, because, as I say, he commanded a corps during the war, and then took over from Slim at 14th Army, which became Burma Command when Slim left.
What did you have to do for him when he went on these journeys? What were your main duties?
Taking notes, really, things that had to be done if he wanted, if he got, because most of the stuff was general staff stuff, although a lot of it was administration as well, because, I mean, if he found that a CO of a battalion said, well, look, I don't get enough, I've been waiting for years for extra boots or something and they haven't come, well then I'd have to make a note of that, and then when I got back I'd have to make up a complete list of everything and then distribute it round for action by those who had to take the action or get their comments. Very often they'd come back and say, we haven't got any, whatever it was, or it couldn't be done, and then you'd have to chase it up to find out whether it really couldn't be done, because people quite often say things can't be done, especially in a hot climate. They have to be chased.
Quartermasters often say they haven't got any.
Oh, that's right, yes.
Even if they had, you're not entitled.
Yes, they guard their stores. I have great admiration for quartermasters. I think they're a brilliant party. Because it reminds me of going up on these visits. I did do one when I was in with 19 Div. I went out to Tongji in the Shan States. And I went in a jeep then. And I remember going up in the mountains. We went for about 100 miles, I suppose. Didn't meet anybody else. And it was a beautiful day, and it was absolutely lovely climate. And I can remember that trip as being almost a holiday, really, from being down in the hot plains. Beautiful. I did a visit down to Singapore as well, to visit Alfsea. My opposite number down there had the Christian name of Mungo, which really is a Christian name because there was a Saint Mungo, wasn't there? I'd never met him, but I knew if I wanted anything out of Alsea, he was the guy I usually spoke to down there. We had a radio telephone connection, rather like speaking on the radio. We couldn't both speak at once. And I had to shout because it was very crackly, and I spent a lot of time shouting out Munger at the top of my voice down this thing. It was, of course, a lot of merriment around everybody else's offices. I think probably also a bit tiresome for people who want to try and work, but it was the only way I could communicate with him, because where our offices were, they were in big, large rooms or halls with partitions, thin partitions, which really didn't go right up to the ceiling. So you could, you know, there was a pretty, you could hear pretty open well what plan. Was going open. Mm. Well, up to a point, yeah, mm. because you did have these partitions, but they were very thin. They're just ordinary three ply wood, I think, or something like that. Anyway, I did go down there to see him. I was lucky enough, I remember, to go down in the Commander-in-Chief's aeroplane, which had plush, comfortable seats in it. It was a DC-3, a Dakota. We went through very stormy weather getting down there, I remember. We went through a whole cloud, and the whole plane went into sort of darkness, except for flashing of lightning. And when I got down there, I was ushered into the Colonel General Staff, GS, who turned out to be no less than Colonel Finlinson, who had been our CO in 2nd Essex, who'd taken over from Geoffrey Elliot. And I think you may remember I said that he was not the same as Geoffrey Elliot. He was a bit more reserved and withdrawn and so forth, and not too easy to get along with, although he was basically a nice man. But when I got down there, he treated me as if I was a long-lost son. I mean, I'd have astonished. Yes, I was astonished how warm he was.
Mm. Well, presumably, when you met him earlier, it was in less relaxed circumstances.
Oh, yes, and completely new, and he had to take over a battalion, which was a whole lot of officers in the battalion, which was used to working under a different sort of regime.
And you were in action.
And we were in action, yeah. Yeah. I think it's about this time that we moved out of Judson College onto Ming Ladon Airport, which was the RAF reserve, to give the college back to the Burmese, which was thought to be a good political move.
Was Burmese political and economic life reviving noticeably at this time? Were you finding that businesses were getting going again and the civil administration was...
Well, there certainly wasn't many Europeans returning. There was one firm, Steel Brothers, I think it was called, who used to work... They had a big company there before the war, and they came back, and they were operating mostly teak and mining. But I don't remember meeting many Europeans there. We used to go out into the town. You could walk about in the town without any problems in Rangoon. It was still very run down. I mean, the Japanese, and obviously during their occupation, had done nothing. And I think, as I mentioned, there was a Strand Hotel there, which was the only one which was really open and used by BOAC slip crews, where you could get a drink and a bit of a meal. But there were places where you could get a steak. I don't know what sort of animal it was, looking back on it.
was there a revival of agriculture in the countryside?
I'm sure there must have been, yes. I don't remember, because we were... there were paddy fields.
You were out and about quite a bit.
The paddy fields were in operation. I think they'd been going since whilst the Japanese were there. I mean, people had to feed even the Japanese army. They had to be fed. Mm. But it would take a long time for them to get back on their feet again. And of course, it's all been put back now, so they haven't really ever got back on their feet again, I don't think. The accommodation out at Ming Ladon was bashers, bamboo and leaves on a concrete base, very primitive. Our headquarters, of course, was running down a bit, I think, now. It was getting smaller.
Were you managing to get the troops then away?
Yes, I think by this time some... Oh, yes, I think some had gone.
So they were being evacuated back to... India or UK.
Yes, yes. I think the Indians were going, found it more, we found it easier to evacuate them than anybody else. Because I mentioned before, when the atomic bomb went off, or both of them went off, everybody was surprised because they didn't know it was going to happen. The war came to a premature end and ships were all over the place loaded with stuff that nobody wanted anymore. So it took an awful long time to get it organised and brought in. But we were running down. I mean, Kit Harper, the other G2, they're gone. And I'd taken over his job. I think also Jack Stone, the G1, went before I did, because I found myself working under the BGS Brigadier Bulger Duke. He was Bulger, he was Duke. It was funny how they all had nicknames in that generation. I mean, Dempsey was called Bimbo, wasn't he? But I don't think it's something he would walk about feeling proud about today's...
Not these days.
Not in this world, no. So we lived out there. I think probably at this time also we were doing things like weapon competitions and athletics. I had to organise both these. I did the weapons command meeting took place in Rangoon, I remember. This is where all the divisions sent teams. And I had to organise it, do all the programming and drawing up of the competitions and what would take place. As far as I can remember, it was mostly application, which was 5 rounds at a target, 200 and 300 yards. Rapid fire, which was getting off 10 rounds in 60 minutes at a target, which would then disappear at the end of 60 minutes, and then snap, where you've got these little round discs on poles which came up mm-hmm. and disappeared. And then falling plates, I think we also did, where you got teams running forward from 300 to 200, and then they had to knock over white metal plates which had been set out in the butts. I don't think it was a time limit. I think there was a time limit, because I remember somebody blowing a whistle, but it was a question of how many. You got two teams running against each other, and the one that knocked down the most plates was obviously the winner, so until you got through to the final. I think we had pistol as well, and probably clay pigeon. And then I had to organise the prize list at the end. And same with the athletics thing, which we had up in Mamio. Now, that was also a command meeting, where I had to organise the whole thing. It was rather like a... It was lovely climate this time of the year, especially up in Mamio. We had a tea tent there, Burma Army band playing. And it was sitting out, and you could be at home in England, really, as far as that bit was concerned.
Sounds very much like a peacetime atmosphere.
Oh, it was, definitely, yes. And one of the problems I had was reading out the names of the... Because I had to read out the names of people who were prize winners, so they came up and got their prize from the general. And I had to stagger through some awful names from Africa and places. One that sticks in my mind was somebody called Gabriel Banana, who came from East Africa, I think.
What did he win?
I can't remember now. I have no idea.
Was there any large-scale military training going on?
No, not, no.
No big exercises?
No big exercises, like that. I can recall. We did have chasing. We did have some military activity of chasing bandits about the place. Dacoits, or trying to round them up. But it was very difficult because they just disappeared into the jungle after they'd committed some. They didn't attack us so much because we were obviously very vulnerable along these roads, which between various garrisons, Rangoon, Tongu, Maktila, Mandalay, they're all on the same long road. And we could have been ambushed at any time. I don't remember an ambush.
But presumably you'd still be a hard target compared to the villagers on whom they'd be able
oh, yes,
to
yes.
Much
yeah,
more
yeah, yeah.
comfortably and easily.
Yes. So, I mean, what I'm saying is that the Dacoits were there, purely there, not politically, but for their own benefit.
Presumably these were really simply criminals rather than...
Yes, yes, but on the other hand, some of the guys would go out at night from the villages and see what they could get. And as I think I mentioned before, the next day you'd see them on a bullock cart. So butter wouldn't melt in their mouths, puffing away at a local cigar, which they all enjoyed. But apart from that, talking of the weapon training again, I remembered it was the second Worcesters who I gave the running of it to. And so they were still there up in Memia, because that's where they were stationed at that time.
Well, they had been in Burma for quite a time, hadn't they? They'd been involved in the fighting at at Kohima.
Where the second Worcesters?
I think they were.
It was the Royal West Kents were there, I know.
Yes, I think they were in the same brigade.
Well, they weren't later, because they were in the brigade which was in 19 Div with the Berkshires and one other battalion which I've remembered earlier and forgotten now. Three regular battalions. They were both second battalions, I think. I know the Royal Berkshires was one of them, Worcesters was one, and then there was one other. But so they'd been in the 19 Div for quite some time, so they may have been transferred. But they took part in the assault on Mandalay, which 19 Div were involved in.
Dorsets, perhaps?
On the Dorsets. It's on the tape somewhere back, but I've forgotten it now. It'll come back to me about 3 o'clock tomorrow morning in bed, I expect. Well, the dry season went, and then we, of course, got the build-up round about end of March, April, or middle of March, build up in the heat for the monsoon, which broke on time in the middle of May, I remember. And I think we were all in our bashes at the time. I think we were off duty. And as soon as the rain came down, we all rushed out into the rain in our underpants and were jumping up and down with the soaking ourselves in the rain, which was a normal sort of ceremony when the monsoon broke. So that must have been, that was in the middle of May, and of course we had mosquito nets out there, and it's very important. You have to keep your mosquito net in excellent condition. It was in fact a disciplinary offence if a mosquito net was found not to be totally
mosquito-proof.
Yeah, that's right. But there's, some of them always got in. They sort of, as you're trying to crawl in underneath, some of the two of them would come whistling in. And then, of course, you spend the night bashing around in the, inside your mosquito net, listening to this awful sort of whine going on. And then in the morning, you wake up and find them hanging on the side inside of the mosquito net, filled with your blood. But very seldom they got in, but it did happen. We were on the edge of a jungle there, so we did get all kinds of animals and flying insects and things coming in. I found a black scorpion in one of my boots one day, I remember. And on another occasion, a dog came rushing into my basher room, as they were, with one clipped to the end of his nose. Where he picked it up from, I don't know, but the scorpion hadn't tried to sting him yet, so I gave it a whack and it came off. But you had to watch out. I mean, they got into all kinds of things. And I remember at night when we had a light outside there, and all kinds of things would come out of the jungle, bang into the light and clonk onto the concrete down. Extraordinary looking things, like flying lobsters and things, which you never see anywhere else. We did have some recreations there. I mean, there was a big lake outside Rangoon, very large lake, which used to go sailing on in dinghies. There was a sailing club there, which was organised. The only problem there was you didn't always get a wind, so you found yourself being
becalmed,
or in irons, as the sailors call it. and you could spend a long time out there, and then you get the paddles out and humiliate yourself by paddling back again, but you couldn't help it. Then we had visits from the Royal Navy. I remember we had some cruisers used to visit Rangoon, and we used to go aboard and have an evening with them, and then they come to us. They always had a piano, I remember, in the wardrooms, which they used to sing. We all got round and sang songs. We sang our songs, they sang their songs. I must say, I know a lot of our songs weren't for family viewing, so to speak, but I must say the Navy outdid us when it came to that sort of thing. But we had some very amusing evenings with them.
What about the Air Force? Did you have...
We didn't see so much of the RAF, as far as I remember.
Mm. But you were on an airfield, weren't
you? We were on an airfield there, but they were all... By that time, there were no... All the fighter element, strike element had gone. Mm. And there was merely transport command there, the DC-3s mostly. And a lot of them had been faded out. But they were used... moving people around, and they were dropping rice, as you may remember I mentioned
yes.
before. They're very dangerous, actually, a lot of their flying. I remember there were during the build-up to the monsoon, and during the monsoon you've got these cumulonimbus clouds, which the RAF always used to refer to as Q-NIMS, and if you got into one of those, aircraft just torn to pieces and thrown out. So they had to get, once they got up there, they were sort of going around them like trees in the forest. And on one occasion, I know three of them, flying in formation, going through CLAG, as they call it, in the RAF. I still call it in civil aviation, actually.
Yes.
Went straight into a mountainside, all three of them.
A cloud can have a concrete centre.
Yes.
RAF saying, I think.
Yes. But they all went into this mountain, all three of them. A hill somewhere, I don't know, I just heard about it. So it wasn't all fun and games as far as the RAF was concerned, flying at that time. There was a swimming pool, and there were clubs, of course, as the officers and club, and there was clubs for the WO sergeants. There was a civilian, and the men, of course, had clubs, and there were a lot of... what you call charity or service, voluntary services there. There was the WASBIS, the Women's Auxiliary Service Burma, who had quite young people amongst them. We got quite friendly with some of them. In fact, at a later stage, I became engaged to one. But there was a queen bee there who kept a very eagle eye as to what was going on, so there wasn't much hanky-panky. But we had to behave ourselves. But unfortunately, what with my being posted abroad and so forth, it eventually fell apart. I mentioned there was a swimming pool, which was a civilian one, which we could use, but it was very like, I used to liken it like jumping into warm syrup. It wasn't really refreshing in any way at all.
But was it too hot?
It was so warm, you know, warm. It's just like warm syrup, as I said. You could jump into it. It gave us a bit of exercise. But as soon as you came out and went into the change room, you were sweating again, as they said.
You mentioned there was a lot of wildlife, exotic. Were there any casualties to the wildlife in the headquarters?
I don't think so. I don't remember. No, I think dysentery was the... You see, we were taking these Mepocrine pills, which should have defended us against malaria, and I think it did, as long as we kept our mosquito nets closed down as well. And, of course, at night, in the evenings, as soon as the evening came, we had to roll down our sleeves
yes.
and put on long trousers. Mm. There, again, it was an offence if you didn't, and very strictly enforced. Mm. But I don't remember anybody. I mean, I suppose somebody could have been bitten by a dog which had got rabies, which I nearly did in Greece, but that's later on.